Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Debbie. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Thank you. Hip hip hooray. Happy birthday.
Thanks, guys.
You and the trees. What a combo.
My bat mitzvah party was actually Tu B'Shvat themed. We had little tree table numbers and we had to make balloon dogs that would water the trees.
I can't see the segue between a big dog and the trees, but...
My dad put out modelling balloons on the tables and people had to figure out how to make a dog to water the tree.
Wow. Dogs water the tree. Okay, who knew? It's a new tradition. I love it. That's great.
She's talking about weeing, Robin. Sorry,
imagining the dogs with watering cans.
No, I don't think they use watering cans.
Yeah, dogs and watering cans, that's the way to go.
Right, that makes more sense. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Glad you clarified. Rabbiting on.
Three rabbits, maybe a guest, doing what rabbits do best. Rabbiting on.
Good, thanks.
Sorry, yeah. Sorry, listeners, that we had to lower the tone to that extent, but she wasn't getting it.
Well, you see, I just don't dip into that, so what can I say? Well, so happy birthday to you, Debbie, and happy birthday to all of the trees as well. It's kind of crazy to think it's been a year since we last spoke about and talked through Tu B'Shvat. That feels very strange. But tell me, before we get into talking about trees and nature and our world, how has your week been?
I think I had an hour yesterday where, if you needed to sum up like a day in the life of the rabbi, yesterday I welcomed 90 students who were here for our first Holocaust Memorial Day workshop, because we have a series of workshops with speakers coming in. So I do the first literally 2 minutes, just hi, welcome, then rushed upstairs to the kindergarten to sing My Roots Grow Down, Down Into the Earth whilst we started our Tu B'Shvat learning in the kindergarten, and then rushed to the Sternberg Centre to take five candidates from FRS to the Beit Din. And as I sat down, I was just like, you know, this is what it's like. Like, every 10 minutes is different. You can't even say every day is different. But you can go from Shoah to Tu B'Shvat to conversion without even the blink of an eye. I would say that's pretty much what every day looks like.
Every moment of every day. Nice. How about you, Debbie? How was your week?
Yeah, similar. Kind of, we've had HMD stuff going on here as well. We had our workshop with students about 2 weeks ago. And this Sunday, we had a performer artist from Israel who was doing a piece around lullabies that came out of the Holocaust and other times of war and genocide, which was really moving. And then I went off to the Holocaust Memorial Day service for Barnet, where Rabbi Mark normally goes. But this time it was Rabbi Debbie's turn, because he's on sabbatical. And had the privilege of singing Amalei Rachamim and reciting Kaddish there. And I think for some people, that jump from Rabbi Mark to Rabbi Debbie was a bit tricky with the singing and things. There were a few slightly uncomfortable looking folk, but that's probably an episode for another time. We're busy planning our Tu B'Shvat Seder for next Sunday.
I'm assuming that discomfort had nothing more to do with the fact that you had boobs and a skirt on or something. Like, I'm assuming it wasn't,
I didn't
anything
leave
like
at home.
It wasn't like an actual Rabbi Debbie thing. It was just a rabbi female thing.
Yes, the change of male rabbi to female rabbi. Yeah. Yes. And personally, we've had our bathroom ripped out, which has been leaking for quite a while in various places. So we currently have no bathroom. We had to put a picture across the doorway last night because the kids were terrified that they were just going to half asleep, wander in there and try and wee in the middle of the night. It's obviously the weeing episode. So we're trying to cope with one toilet and no shower this week.
Nice. I'm glad we're doing this online and not in a small room, because the smell might not work.
I did shower yesterday morning before it was ripped out. Very good. How about you, Robin? How's your week been? There's been a lot going on for you.
The flavour of this episode feels very different to normal, but I'm enjoying it. Yes, I've had quite an intense week, only because obviously Holocaust Memorial Day always brings a certain... I think the Shoah is always kind of relatively front and center with the work that we do, or why we're doing our work in some ways. So that was intense, and some really amazingly powerful events I went to in Manchester with some of the community. But also I gave in my notice this week because I am stepping into doing a PhD and rabbinic work in the north, all around female prophetic leadership. So a lot of the themes we've been talking about around rabbinic leadership and what it is to be a woman and the male models and how we fit in or can't fit into them. So I'm stepping down from my post in July. Quite an emotional week, but I'm also just looking forward to all the next chapters.
Good luck for this career. New chapter.
Mazel tov.
Walking the journey with you.
Yeah, looking forward to lots of wisdom.
Yes, well, I will probably also be interviewing you for my PhD. So thank you. Just take that as agreement. It's public, so...
No problem. I'm most interested in the male model bit that you were talking about and whether that's a pictorial dissertation or how that works.
Now, that is one route to go to. I could have like a whole picture section with an appendix. It's nice. Great. Yeah, lovely. I've got lots of really odd images, I have to say, in my brain at the moment. Right. So as well as talking about dogs weeing on trees or with water in cans and trees, this Tu B'Shvat and female rabbis and male models and all sorts, we also on Rabbiting On talk a lot about life hacks, about how to be better, how to live better, how to live Jewishly. I don't know about you, but I have been speaking to my friends that last year when we had the hottest year on record in the UK, along with other countries around the world, I really felt a sense of the world screaming out, Ayeka, where are you? Which is a word from Genesis. For me, it really woke me up in a way that a lot of the climate crisis conversations and reality hadn't quite hit me. Last year, I really felt it in my body. And we know probably the statistics and the information around it, that in May, we recorded the highest concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in history. And when I say history, I literally mean in hundreds of thousands of years. And we know this from ice core dating. And in May, we reached 422 parts of CO2 per million. And as I've learnt, if you track concentrations of CO2, you immediately see a correlation with global temperature. And we have only 7 years now before 2030. So do either of you know why 2030, the year, is so significant?
Is it some kind of tipping point?
It's awful, isn't it? This kind of sense of like impending doom. It's so hard. But producer Dan did tell us that with climate stuff, it's going to feel hard, but it will feel better once we start talking it through. So we can start with that impending doom. And I had it with Gable, who's doing some homework recently. And I said, you know why that is? It was around geography. And he said something like, well, yes, because the world is getting hotter and animals are dying, and it felt just so hard. So yes, 2030 is the limit that we've been given by climate scientists that we have to keep below 1.5 degrees of warming on pre-industrial levels, or we risk irreversible permanent damage from climate change. So it's a key milestone in the 2050 net zero target set by the government. So that's a year on the way towards that. And I think we all know that we're nowhere near the target. If we've seen any headlines recently of reports coming out, very far from meeting the targets established in the 2015 COP21 Paris Climate Accords. But in Manchester, as always, leading the way, there's good news and a good example of Dugma Ishit, leading by self-example, because we as a region have been recognised that we kickstarted the global addiction to fossil fuels. So we're really leading the way as a city region to educate the population in carbon literacy, reduce climate change, and we're working towards net zero by 2038, which is 12 years before the 2050 target. So although Manchester had a lot to account for, also trying to now chart a way forward.
That's so interesting. It had never occurred to me to think of like, where in England can we most blame for this? Like, it's so interesting to hear Manchester is kind of like taking responsibility as one of the core industrialised areas. I just think that's really fascinating. And that tension, I think, between the government setting a goal and actually, you know, needing to legislate for us to make change versus the impact on individual lives, it's a very real tension. We've been talking a lot in our household this week about the ULEZ that's coming in London. So the ultra low emission zone has been in place for a few years now, and they're expanding it to cover all London boroughs, which basically means at work, I'm inside the ULED zone, and at home, we're not. So if I come with my kids on a Sunday morning, because my kids are the only kids at Jewish day schools who love also going to religion school on a Sunday morning. So I bring my kids on a Sunday morning in my little hybrid, lovely eco car. And occasionally I then have to go off afterwards and do a stone setting or something. And Gary usually comes in, my husband, in our diesel big camping car to fit all the equipment in that we purchased before we were told diesel was a bad thing. Diesel was originally meant to be more eco. And actually for long journeys, it is seen as better. It's sort of a complicated picture, but it's not ULEZ compliant. So will we pay £12.50 every time he needs to pick the kids up, or will we put them on a bus, or will I have to take them out of the ULEZ zone? Or, and so he, my Gary's got really interested in these campaign groups around the ULEZ who are saying, you know, this is really going to impact our livelihoods. We live in this zone. We won't be able to afford to replace our car. And I can't not use the car because I need to work and the public transport doesn't work properly. And on the other hand, if we don't do something legislatively about air quality and about carbon, nothing will change. And it's this tension of how much these things impact people's individual lives versus how we make change as a community.
I'm also really aware that before these things ever come in, we only fixate on, well, how would, you know, how can we possibly do this? Like, this just won't work for us. This, you know, in exactly the picture you've just painted of, like, I can totally understand how for your family that doesn't work. And what I realize is it's actually only when these things are brought in, we all find our workarounds. We all work with the new reality and it makes such a huge difference. You know, I had Bags for Life in the back of my car for so many shopping trips that never came into the supermarket with me, because, like, oh yeah, I didn't remember till I was in. All of a sudden the tax came in where we actually had to pay for our bags, and I remember to bring them in. It's not like I couldn't afford the 5p or whatever it was, but, like, all of a sudden there was something that changed. And, you know, the number of short journeys I didn't do when the fuel crisis was on and we just, like, couldn't get petrol for a couple of weeks, I didn't need the car as much as I use it all the time. And I'm just wondering if sometimes it's so much better when these things are just legislated for and we manage them, we cope with them. And it's just, I think I talk about it a lot. This, my problem with politics is our politicians need to be popular. So all of a sudden, you know, the ULEZ thing will come in London. Sadiq Khan won't get mayor again because, like, he's the demon that brought it in. But actually, like, we need leadership that can take the unpopular, drastic view and just make these things happen.
And there's something, I always remember this news report from BBC Look North, I think it was, about 2 to 3 weeks after the charge for the plastic bags came in, where they interviewed fishermen from around the Hull area, and they were saying they could already see less plastic in the water than they had 3 weeks earlier.
I'd be so happy to take, like, Tupperware to the supermarket and fill my Tupperware with rice or pasta or whatever, right? But nobody's making me do that. There's not, like, you know, those supermarkets as prevalent around me or as accessible or as cheap as the supermarkets I go into. It must be cheaper for them to have me come and take from a big barrel than pick up these, you know, plastic containers of all of these things. I just don't understand why it's taking supermarkets so long to make those changes. Like, I know I should take responsibility. I know I should pick up the broccoli that's loose and not the broccoli that's covered in plastic for no apparent reason, and all of those kind of things. I'm the weak link. I just need the supermarkets to do it for me, because if I couldn't pick up a broccoli that was covered in plastic, I wouldn't have that extra bit of plastic in my fridge.
Ultimately, we need proper systemic change. And I live a very idealized capitalist life, which is as a consumer. You know, I don't know if you heard the Amazon beep before, but I have like shipments coming today. And I've like tried to wean myself off like just getting one thing because I think about, or you know, the emissions or whatever of the van coming. But I live a lot, it's all about quick, isn't it? So we go into the supermarket, you can grab what you need to. We want things to last as long as they can. We're primed to work in a way that
no
cares
pun intended
more about that.
With the prime.
What did I say?
Primed.
It's on brand. I'm really not trying. Yeah. It's like the sermon I gave that was very profound, but I mentioned Netflix in it. And then congregants came up and said, I think I'm going to sign up to Netflix. It's like, that wasn't the point of the sermon. So this is not the point of the podcast for you all now to go, I think I should get Prime. But like the capitalist world, we're little kind of beings that are primed to one, overwork and do everything like that, but also, you know, buy things quickly, do things quickly. And it's all about profit. It's all about productivity. And it's much less about well-being, and it's even less about how it affects nature and the environment. And I'm trying really hard to put a new set of lenses on, almost, of how to see the world and what I'm outputting and how I'm behaving. But also that systemic change, we need the governments to be radical and take the risks and supermarkets to lead the way, because I think we're all crying out for it. And it's quite overwhelming, isn't it? Although it should be, it's worth saying that the UK is actually... which I was interested to learn because this isn't always what I understand in this and I need to get more educated. But the UK is actually doing really quite well overall. So we should be encouraged that we have a way to go. But we're one of the best performing countries in the world in terms of delivering on our climate goals, which puts even more burden or motivation on us to do our part. So do you have any like tips or any ways that you've changed habits, maybe given what's happened last year and how it was the hottest on record? Is there anything, Debbie, you've always led the way in terms of climate education and doing things, but
she's going to shame me.
We shouldn't start with Debbie.
I wasn't going to talk about that. What I think I often feel we miss as an opportunity as religious leaders is, in fact, Judaism is incredibly radical in its answer to a lot of what you were just saying, Robin. For me, Shabbat and Shemitah, which is the seventh sabbatical year, are incredibly radical answers to this image of us as, you know, humans are consumers. That's the model. Actually, no, Judaism doesn't think that is the perfect model. Judaism needs us to keep things in balance. 6 days of the week, we are consumers, we are workers, we are changing the world, engaging with the world. But rather than having one day a year, like there's people have campaigns for, you know, no shopping day. I can't remember which date it is, but there's a date where everyone says no shopping day, and there's a power down day, you know, turn off your iPhones and da da da. We do that once a week, actually. I do that once a week, right? Every Shabbat, I don't shop. I'm not a consumer. I do try and cut off from the news cycles and the technology in meaningful ways, and to not change the world. You know, when we say we're going to go as far as our body takes us rather than using our polluting cars, which isn't okay, like not everyone can do that on Shabbat, but, you know, to think about how we impact the world every week rather than once a year. And then the Shemitah year, this sabbatical year, every seventh year, is an even more radical way of saying, we have to understand, for the last 3,000 years, Judaism has understood you cannot endlessly demand of the earth and expect her to keep giving. Once every 1 year out of every seven, you stop demanding and you live on what the land gives you. And you also acknowledge that you don't own what you think you own. It returns to God. It returns to ownerlessness. And every 50th year, it returns to its original owner. So no one owns anything in perpetuity, really. And actually breaking this cycle of I need, I have, I must consume. And look behind me, like I definitely have issues with consuming and buying stuff. But it's a really important wake up. So two Shemitah cycles ago, I experimented with myself with not shopping for the year except for food, that I tried to be as like plastic free and locally sourced as possible. I did a lot of campaigning around who are our slaves, because in the seventh year you release your slaves. Us, you know, we have slaves making our clothes and all sorts of other things, buying secondhand. And we have enough baby stuff in the world to keep us going for at least a decade, I reckon, without people buying new things. And there are lots of amazing networks where mums pass things on between each other, but we're still buying new all the time. And I think we forget that you take something to the dump or you put it in your bin and it's gone. It's not gone. It's still on the planet. Nothing vanishes. So just being conscious of beyond our own little worlds, I think, is a really big part of it. But no shaming of anyone.
Yeah. Amen.
Amen. I was going to say amen. That was like preaching. I loved it. And it makes me think, because often when I try and talk about the climate crisis, and Rabbi Daniel Lichtman talks about, he asked the question, what would it be like if communities were climate realist, which I think is really interesting. And obviously there's the eco-synagogue movement that's helping us go that way. But I often struggle with this kind of thing when I'm talking about it in community, of not preaching, of not being kind of a dictator around it or holier than thou. So what was amazing, Debbie, is actually the theology of nature, which is so inherent in Judaism, because Judaism isn't capitalist. It's countercultural to all of that, or industrial. It was basically agricultural, but really puts values, humanity and nature first always. So we've got those amazing Torah passages about what to do with trees when you're besieging a city.
But I'm not sure radical. I'd say that it isn't capitalist. I think it's about that balance, right? It's about saying you can't endlessly consume and expect to still be okay.
I think I meant like biblical Torah theology, for want of a better word, whether it's theology or not, is not like capitalism comes later, like post-industrial.
It does,
revolution.
But I think that, you know, we do have, you know, business ethics in Torah, and you know, thinking about how we consume is part of the Torah ethic. And if we're looking at economic models, for me, it is that sense of balance. And yes, love of nature, absolutely. But also there is an acknowledgement in that text you're reciting in Deuteronomy about don't cut down the fruit trees in a war. That's also self-interest, right? It's, you can use trees that don't produce fruit to create your battering rams, but don't use the fruit-bearing trees because you're going to need those or you'll starve. And I think there is a sense of self-preservation that we all need to wake up to, really, because it feels self-preserving to be safe in our homes. But in three generations, we need to think forward, you know, what is actually going to be looking after that generation too. And of course, trees are a core part of how we do that. So lots of communities will be planting trees this weekend. And we've had lots of trees being planted for the Queen's Jubilee and all sorts of things. You know, trees are the most powerful carbon sink. So they will absorb our carbon. And the destruction of the Amazon has been a huge part of creating the issues that we're now facing. So when we're planting trees, in fact, Midrash says that planting a tree makes you like God. If you want to walk in God's way, plant a tree, because when you plant a tree, you create an entire self-sustaining ecosystem, just as God created the world as an entire self-sustaining ecosystem. So a tree isn't just a tree. It supports birds, insects, shade for humans, fruit for animals and humans. It's this whole complicated system. And they weren't probably even aware of the carbon sink element of it. So trees are so, so important, this Tu B'Shvat. For me, it's always been such a joy that our Judaism takes this time to celebrate such an important part of how we live.
And I'm really taken with the work of Greta Thunberg and David Attenborough and all these kind of leaders who use, well, in Greta's case, created a platform to be able to create change. But David Attenborough, who has used his position to really tell a narrative and to bring people along with him. What do you think about in our positions as leaders of communities, about how we use that for good, how you create change?
I think there's something to be said for being able to take the experiences of the community in the moment that they're in and to be able to kind of use it for that bigger platform. So, you know, I was really struck by the lack of climate conversation around the pandemic. Like, there was a real kind of, in that moment where we stopped, where air pollution came down because we were simply not flying from country to country as much.
Or driving anywhere.
Right, where people were not in their cars as much, all of that kind of thing. I go on holiday, I drive distances that probably I could walk if I had slightly slower pace of my day, then I would be able to cut out the car much more often because I would be able to take that time to walk and all of that kind of thing. I think for me, I'm not the best role model in terms of my practice, but I think we can use our position to be able to take people from the moment and allow them to look into the impact of the generations to come as well. And to be able in that way to be thinking consciously about our behavior. You know, I'm fascinated by the kind of life hacks that people are talking about in order to reduce the cost of the energy that they're using at the moment. You know, that actually people are much more into the conversation around energy prices and therefore lessening consumption in terms of keeping the heating off, drying clothes more efficiently, all of those kind of things, because it's affecting our pockets right now, than they are about, you know, this is what we need to be doing for the generations to come in order to lessen the impact on climate crisis. And I'm not belittling in any way the problem that many, many people are facing right now, which is they can't afford to heat their homes. But actually, we need to be looking for the long-term solutions to that and to be able to insulate people's homes better and to be able to be living differently rather than necessarily for it just to be about in the moment and people's inability to pay.
I have found myself wondering if this is a government trying to, or a world government somewhere trying to kind of put prices up to get us practicing how to ensure we reduce our consumption, because we have to.
That was our first conspiracy theory.
Right. Well, because also we went from pandemic to petrol, you know, crisis, whatever, to energy crisis. Like, I understand the politics behind it, but actually we need to be using these also as triggers, not just to cope with the immediate crisis we're in.
You know, the changes that we can make are privileges, yeah, really, that come with it. So the idea of climate justice, about actually how do we make sure with the tragic opportunities we get through these world events, how can we make sure that we come into a world that is more equitable, that we're thinking of everybody? And a thing that is a really interesting thing that I'm going to do later today, which I've not done before, is thinking about a carbon budget. And producer Dan is very hot on this stuff, and it's really interesting to rethink our own personal and family's carbon emissions, and to start thinking about a carbon budget like you would manage your finances or how you spend in that sense, to think about a carbon budget. And there are really easy things that you can do to go, which I'm going to do later. You can measure your own carbon footprint. There's free online calculators, and you can find the links in the show notes. And also think about changing energy supplies to a renewable tariff.
I like that idea. If my son does not get a lift to school any day for a particular term, but then we can go on a holiday at the, you know, in the holidays, you know, we'll have saved our budget of car, little car, horrible journeys in town into a, and now let's go and spend, you know, a week somewhere.
Do either of you have any tips on getting your family to turn the lights off? Because I feel like I'm endlessly walking around the house turning lights off after people are shouting, come back upstairs, why is your light on?
When Ben was in reception at school, they learnt this dreadful song that was, when you leave the room, turn off the lights. It went on like this. And basically, for ages after that, every time he walked out of a room, I would start singing. And now I think he just tries to avoid me singing. And therefore, you know, it's like, please don't sing the song. I've turned the light off. But I can still hear my dad going, it's like Blackpool Illuminations, every time we arrived back at our house and we'd left all the lights on, and we arrived back in the dark to see all the lights that we'd left on.
Wow. I have to say, it's one of our strengths. We're very particular, shall we say, and we always turn off the lights. I remember watching this little YouTube video on BBC or something about a dad, an American guy, who had a timer on the fridge that you could only open it like 10 seconds because it let out energy.
You know, in hotel rooms where you walk in and you have to put the key in the little thing to make the electricity go on in that room. I've always wondered if you could have one for the whole house where, you know, as you walk in, but when you take the key out to walk out the door, just everything shuts down. You know, that's basically what we need.
Yeah, and we've got that in our new building, temporary home at Manchester Reform, automatic lights. So if you're not using it, they go off, which seems really smart. So these are all the kind of things, again, the systemic stuff.
When you're sitting in your office, though, we've got them here, and I'm often like, hello.
Going back to our earlier theme, I've had that on the loo quite a lot. There are quite a lot of public toilets with these timed lights, and you're sort of, if you're there too long, you have to start waving on the loo.
It's a shame. Yeah, I like it when I'm teaching like a conversion class or something and I've said something, you know, as I do,
profound
joke, and then all the lights go out. It's like, whoa. But that only happens once in a blue moon.
Although it also happens the other way. So I'll have been teaching at shul and we'll be the last people in the building. So then like just the light in the classroom we've been using is on, no other lights in the building. And I'll just pop up to my office to get like my coat on the way out. But the walk from the room to my office turns on every light in the whole building as I walk out. So then I leave the building with all the lights on with no means of also just being able to go, okay, let's cut all the lights because I'm walking out. Every building needs a big kind of one swoop lights off kind of facility.
There you go. You heard it here first, planners and architects. And also obviously smart energy meters are a way that helps us to be kind of active and mindful about these things. I think that is part of it, isn't it, about habit forming, is having things in place in front of us to be mindful of how we're acting, to slow us down so we're not on automatic pilot but actually can act a little bit differently as well.
And sometimes thinking about those things that feel like they're convenient and making our lives easier, but actually in the long term are going to create a great deal more inconvenience. So, I mean, one of the things we've been seeing locally a lot is flooding. More and more people have got plastic lawns instead of grass. And grass absorbs the water, trees absorb the water, plant, enjoy your gardens. I mean, that was something else we learned in lockdown, right? The importance of our outdoor spaces. Plastic lawns are going to create greater problems as well as being plastic that we now can't get rid of in the dumps. That sense of, well, this is going to be much easier for me for the next few years. Think beyond that.
Those are important words to end on. So I think we've covered a lot, haven't we, in terms of Jewish text and theology, and also some sharing of some practices and questions to ask ourselves.
Would you not agree that what we've really learned is it's not just what you see in the world, but that actually all of us, our roots grow down, down into the earth. Our roots grow down. I think we need some Swedish fat singing.
I think you've done
let's
it.
Let's water it. Oh, let's water it. Give the dog a water can.
Whoosh. It's like a Swedish fat song medley.
It's nice. Are you two done?
Do you want sister? Us to be Robin?
No, trees carry on are blowing.
There we go. In the wind they're blowing. Trees are blowing in the wind. Whoosh.
Whoosh. I think I'm done.
You're done. Okay, great. As well as singing Tubish Fat tree songs.
Plant.
We know that lots of our synagogues are involved in the eco-synagogue movement. Rabbi Mark is really involved in that. We've talked about carbon footprint measuring, which you can do to become carbon literate. All links are in the show note. And if that phrase is new to you, carbon literacy is an awareness of the carbon costs and impacts on everyday activities and the ability and motivation to reduce emissions on an individual, community and organisational basis. So food for thought, and hopefully something to lead to action as well. We spoke about looking at your tariff, energy tariffs, to a more renewable tariff. Really easy to do. So it would be great if you could also send us your life hacks in. We love hearing from all of our listeners in our community of Rabbiting On. So you can email us media@rjuk.org. And hi to everyone who's been in touch on WhatsApp. If you want to join the party, you can get in touch on 07922 575583. And just before we close this episode, it's impossible just not to mention and send all of our deep love and support to Rabbis Sybil and Jonathan on the devastating news of Ben, their son, passing away. So just we're sending all of our love in solidarity and strength to you and all your family. Lots of love. We'll say goodbye for now, and we'll be with you in a couple of weeks' time. Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.